Hello and welcome to episode 35 of Long Shots, our weekly podcast, the usual two or three person spiel that me and Sharad does, discussing business, finance, and anything relevant from the consumer interest perspective. Just a friendly reminder to all our listeners, as usual, we are now streaming on iTunes, Deezer, Spotify, and pretty much any other podcast app that you like or prefer. So do subscribe to our channel so that you get that nice little notification every time an episode goes live. So with that house rule behind us, this is me, Nikhil Arora, and I have with me Sharad Tupran. Sharad, how's it going, man?
Not bad. Can't complain. It's hot now, and I'm really glad that we're doing a podcast when we have our coffee cups.
For yes.
That's a new.
Sipping hot cups of coffee. As per the request from our special guest today. But like before we go to that side, today is a bit different, right? Like our first two guests this season were from a, I would say, more gray end of the spectrum, like not in terms of age, but at least in terms of what they do. Yeah. One was a structured credit analyst, the other guy was a lawyer.
But today we have
someone working in a slightly more glamorous end of things, even though I think her work on a day-to-day basis might be more ops heavy than we think.
So, just like Uber and Ola's that we've discussed.
Yes, pretty much that. So here we have with us Shreya Soni, a dear friend from our school and the founder of Delhi Secret Supper Club, DSSC. Shreya, how's it going?
Hi guys, thanks for having me here.
No, Shreya, it's a pleasure to have you. And we obviously have been seeing you go through this journey in the past, I would say, 6 to 7 years now.
Yes.
Yeah.
We just hit our 6th year mark a couple of months back.
So our LinkedIn research was pretty spot on.
I'm impressed. Yes. Well done, guys.
It's updated as well.
It's updated.
Equally impressive.
Yeah. So yeah, you were in London. You were there as a consultant at
yes.
UI.
Yes.
Then you decided to step back, come back home.
Yeah.
What was the, how did that decision come up?
So I feel technically that was my first job as part of the career progression. It was one of the best teams to work with.
Mm.
And I think also the timing, as morbid as that sounds, it was a very opportune time for my role to kick in, because just when the financial crisis kicked in, the need for change management and organizational structure and optimization kicked in. So I got to work on like a lot of great projects of streamlining processes, operations and teams. No complaints there. I think London is one of the most glorious cities that one can kind of live in. But there was a bit, there was a small niggle in my head that kept me wondering about what's happening back home.
Right.
So back in 2012 is when a lot of very interesting entrepreneurial projects and stories were coming out of this side
right.
of the world. And I was just curious to know what's happening. So I actually put in my papers. My team very sweetly didn't accept. They thought I was homesick.
Right.
So I came back on a 3-month sabbatical.
Oh, okay.
And they were fully confident that I'm just going to hate it back home.
Right, right.
Feel the pollution and come running back. But then ended up staying. And now Delhi's home.
Oh, nice.
Now it's been six, 7 years now.
Yeah, that's true.
And so tell us a little bit about DSSC. We know what it stands for.
Yeah.
But walk us through what it typically entails.
Yeah.
Is it like, I know there are a lot of different nuances to think about, but let's call it a one line or a brief description on sort of what you offer to the clients. And I've been in some events that you guys have done, and it's been always a pleasure and a great, it's been a great experience. So, but I want to understand from a commercial standpoint, what does it entail?
Okay, so I'm going to actually trace back and tell you how this even started. I had moved back to India to work on a couple of projects around kind of like rural tourism, ecotourism, farmer empowerment, etc. And during my time working on those projects, even though I absolutely loved coming back to this city that was so different, say like 6-7 years back, because it was kind of bursting at its cultural seams, I felt like there was a great amount of like dullness in the conversation available in the city. And I feel like everyone was either very comfortable within their cliques, or there weren't very many safe environments or legitimate platforms for like-minded people to get together. So with that in mind, the idea was really simple. To me, the best way to break ice is when you break bread.
Right.
So the idea was to kind of like get like-minded people under the same roof at the same time.
Right.
And have almost like an experience which didn't have any agenda, which is why we make sure that we steer clear from the idea of either it was it a social club, was it a networking club. It was an experience of whatever you wanted to get out of it.
And which people remember. And that's, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we used to get a lot of requests saying, you know, is this a singles only club? Is there, right. this is a platform to meet a lot of single people? I said, yeah, unless you're Ryan Gosling, then no.
Right.
But I think like literally it stemmed from a big gaping kind of gap and hole in my experience once I was back in Delhi.
But the gap was more in terms of discovery, or was it more in terms of actually those kind of special things not happening?
You know, it was a mix of like a couple of things, I'll be honest. So it was a mix of a platform for curated discovery.
Right.
I feel like we live in a country which is such a rich landscape for everyday discoveries. I mean, you could walk out of the office right now and we have like at least a zillion touch points that engage or pull on your senses, right? So I don't think we're lacking in that. But I feel like in terms of curated discovery, in terms of like quality, like-minded conversation and discussion. And the third one was experiences.
Right.
So I feel like it became like a trifecta where the project soon became, how do you provide a solution to tackle these three points?
Okay.
The reason why we remained secret was actually quite simple. At that point in time, a lot of startups that were coming to play, a lot of focus was being spent on the founder and not the product.
Right.
Now, I'm just going to assume that we all also actually come from families where, you know, our parents, our uncles, aunts, grandparents, they've always built products, they've built projects where it's been their work ahead of who they were. It almost became kind of like irrelevant about who was driving that project. So in my head, I thought if I'm running a secret supper club, a concept that is actually, it rolls around the globe quite often.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. So you have like secret supper clubs. I attended one in Paris, I attended one in London.
Right.
But it's more, the format is you go into a secret location, usually typically the host's home, and it's
right.
a beautiful sit-down dinner,
okay.
which is more around experimental ingredients.
We obviously missed out on a bit of stuff there.
Yeah, I know. We'll come to how you break into the other side of that secrecy.
Yeah.
How do you get into
basically
those?
it takes a glutton to find such experience.
Right. No, I was like, okay, so I thought that's like, I was giving too much credit to you. I thought this is like completely your, you know, end-to-end.
No, I won't like take credit for that. I promise. Supper
right.
clubs exist.
Oh, okay.
All yeah. over the world, but none from this subcontinent. So the reason I thought it would be fun as an experiment to keep it secret end to end,
right?
Because I wanted to kind of like test.
So, like, just for the benefit of the listeners, when you say end to end, you mean even your identity was unknown, right?
So,
for
right
quite
from
some time.
Identity to details about the experience. So, other than you getting an email with just in terms checking your availability about date and time,
right.
there were no other details given. You weren't allowed a plus one, you weren't allowed a friend that could act as a security blanket, you weren't told what cuisine, you weren't told where, nothing.
Right.
Next set of details, once you kind of RSVP, you would get it 12 hours before the experience.
Okay. What about dietary restrictions? I'm just kidding.
No, but I would always ask for allergies and dietary restrictions, because now, like, you know, everyone's allergic to something.
Gluten.
Something. No, gluten is still, like, generous. Now I get requests like, I am allergic to a certain kind of water.
What?
Now,
really?
Very hard to cater to that. So
right.
then we just ask, like, what's your preferred brand of water?
Oh,
wow.
We'll just serve that.
Interesting. Interesting. Very interesting.
But I mean, like, what's interesting also is that, like, you mentioned that no agenda.
Yeah.
Like, no agenda is, I think that makes it fascinating because, you know, I mean, there are all of these structured events which keep on happening.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a natural bit of inertia which comes about,
yeah.
you know, going there. Because, like, we for instance, we firmly feel that, you know, those formal networking events,
yeah.
I mean, they kind of are a half measure most of the time.
Yeah, still have to give yourself a pep talk to go for
to
them.
To go there. Plus,
know?
I mean, in terms of actual, like,
yeah.
relationships, like for instance, I personally feel that bilateral conversations
yeah.
are probably more effective. But yeah, I mean, this no agenda, is that also a signature element of supper clubs all over, or that's something that you think is...
I think it was a more personal decision for me. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you why, because I was fully cognizant of the fact that a lot of factors of this secret experience could put people off, meaning which... You don't know who's writing to you. It could jolly well be like the creep next door.
Right.
You didn't have any set of details about what, why, who, nothing.
Right.
So I think the hook was that there is no agenda. You don't like it, please feel free to leave. And I would add in like a bad joke, and Sharad knows how fabulous my jokes are. And I'd be like, you know what, if you feel at any point in time of the experience it's not up your alley, please throw the serviette to the person on your left, fling your drink on your right and leave. So I feel like that kind of, the option of kind of no restrictions, you can leave if it's not up your alley. It almost acted like a healthy buffer and kind of security blanket to go.
Right.
And to go solo.
But like all the, like the opacity around the process.
Yeah.
Did it make it challenging to market it? I assume it did, right? I mean, how are you kind of dealing with that particular problem?
So I'll be very honest. I feel like I may present an extremely atypical case study because it wasn't challenging for me.
Okay.
There was a gap in the market in terms of experiential marketing. Right. There was a gap in the market for curated experiences that actually got word of mouth marketing, which in my mind is almost like the stickiest form of like,
absolutely,
almost like legitimacy,
right?
So was it hard for me to market this? Not at all. It actually started off as a one-off social experiment. And then I paused for a couple of weeks because I went back to work. I had a great time. I didn't attend most of, you know, DSSE experiences over the course of 4 years. And that one secret experiment then started getting a lot of demand, not only from the consumers, because of word of mouth saying, oh, but my friend went here, how can I get on the list?
Right.
The minute you get the question, how can I get on a list?
Yeah.
You know, you're onto something hot. And then the minute you start getting word of mouth from the consumer end is when the demand and like say everyone from the industry picks up. Because they need to park their funds somewhere.
But I mean, like, isn't it true that in the beginning, like, you, there's not much of a demarcation between you and your company, right? I mean, like,
there isn't.
You are the person, you are the company, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that entire brand perception takes some time to build in.
Yeah.
But like in this case, you yourself was like practically incognito, right?
Yeah.
So it was like some...
So it kind of like almost took the form of your creative imagination.
Right.
So since our mode of communication was solely emails.
Right.
And it was signed off as my alter ego, which was Stevie. And is Stevie till date.
Right.
The banter became kind of essential.
Okay.
Meaning which that there would be a fair amount of like research and homework in me gathering information about you. I know in today's day and time how what the connotation of like my explanation would be, but back in the day it became a kind of a tool to personalize my communication with you, coming from the fact that it's coming from an anonymous person.
Right.
So that was almost like this trust building exercise. So people assumed either it's someone they know, which 80% of the time didn't. I didn't know half of or more than half of my members. And it almost takes the avatar of who you want that person to be.
Right.
And that became like...
So it's like a personality got attached to Stevie, the email.
Yeah.
And then...
Yeah, so for a lot of like women,
right,
I know a lot of them thought I was a guy.
Right.
Because I would keep like... there was this like high level of banter going. So they would just assume that it's a guy. And for a lot of the gents in the club, they thought it was one of their homies. Because then I would actually research about... you know, what's their favorite sport and thereby club. And like, you guys know, I have minimal information about sport, but I would get myself to read a little bit more about the Lakers or whichever cricket team and then throw that in.
And then
they'd assume that, oh, you know, one of the boys.
Okay.
So it literally took form of the reader's imagination.
Right.
And what happened when you finally broke it, when you finally unleashed your true identity of DSSE or yourself?
Well,
that must have been an interesting experience.
Oh, yeah, it was actually like, it took like months to get to that decision because I don't think I ever wanted to, I mean, come out, so to speak, of the secret closet. because in very ways and forms, I thought that was the hook of the company. But I think we got to this intersection where growth and scale, and when I say growth and scale, not so much like across the board, but like deeper into advisory projects, it became imperative that clients and paying clients have a face to speak with. And you can't have voice diffusers on Skype, and you can't have only email communication.
Voice diffusers were used?
Yeah. So basically everything I read as a child...
Make all the cut for CIA or...
Yeah, even like the team didn't know. It was me, by the way. So the team kind of like, we built a system where they thought I was at max a Delhi manager.
Right.
Every 3 weeks, a new rumor was floated in the city about who it could be.
Oh, okay.
And everyone kind of assumed the founders were sitting out of Bombay. And they were like a group of guys, by the way, because women can't...
Because Stevie...
And a little bit of connotation of Stevie, but also like the operational logistics of it.
Right.
It was naturally assumed that it's a...
So you were like Shreya, the Delhi manager.
Yeah.
That was kind of established internally.
Internally.
Right. Well, nothing
with the with our clients, there was a spreadsheet where should we get on a call with any client or an email, there were six names that were used between like the three of us, whoever was client facing at that point in time. So from Monica, Tara, Naina, and then everyone would just log down which name was used for which client.
Right.
So that if anyone else is picking up that conversation, you look at that spreadsheet, say, oh, for this client, the last name used was Tara. And then you pick up the phone and say, yeah, this is Tara from DSSE, how may I help?
That's awesome. I'm glad secret is in your name because that's fundamental to the entire...
Yeah, it really was. Yeah, and then we kind of like figured that... logistically and for the growth of the company, because we wanted to do more and we wanted to dabble with more social experiments, we decided to come out. So the team was told like 25 days before so that they can chip in and also help with
So that's pretty interesting, right? Like you use secrecy to sort of build a buzz around it, and that was your hook and maybe even a moat in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
So how did sort of you transition into advisory side? And that's, I'm guessing, a little bit of a different, I don't want to say a different business line, because I think there's a lot of overlapping
core
strengths and core skills, but sort of how did you make that pivot? And I'm guessing this is where we are now with DSSE. Would you call it like a advisory slash experience curation kind of a
place? So from like initially working on immersive secret experiences, now we've kind of like organically moved to a space where we're one of the key players in the market for experiential marketing and creative services.
Right.
So yes, we still host secret suppers. Yes, we still host all the experiences that we used to host back in the day. But now there's just a very organic kind of like extension to our scope of work.
Right.
So, I mean, we're all aware India's it's a great market for existing and new brands who haven't ever tapped into this TA. So they need a lot of help with kind of building what is their go-to-market. So we help with that.
I was just reading, was it yesterday, that sort of Indian food service market, like growing, expected to grow at like 10% plus CAGR until 2025, will be a 5 lakh crore business, right? I mean, I know you guys do more than just food service, but that itself is a significant piece of the pie.
I want to say it still is the core.
It is? Okay.
Yeah. So food and beverage remains the core. And then the extensions and the other divisions in the business are now around tech, lifestyle, fashion. Basically anything that like kind of interests our consumer and member.
But like in terms of, if you look at pure play curation work, right? So that's, I guess, end to end kind of do the entire thing, right? Are these paid events... Is this completely a sponsorship play there? And on the other end, obviously, when you look at advisory side, what, I mean, that I guess is a more project-based kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? But within that, what kind of brand would come to you? Or is it like just small brands? Is it like boutique-y brands? Are there big brands who want to do something more, you know,
it's
specialist?
It's a mix of both. Right. I'll be honest, in terms of like our profile of kind of clients and brand partners, it could go in right from like a more boutique e-commerce website like a Natty.
Right.
Or it could be, you know, your bigger brands that have international presence like a Google or a Monkey 47 or a Bacardi or a Hyatt. I mean, basically it's actually across the board in terms of who seeks our services. In terms of the previous question you asked about, like, what's the model?
Yeah.
It's part sponsorship and it's part ticketed.
Okay.
So it depends on also the objectives of the client. So say, for example, a client comes and they're new in the market and they literally want to build an experience which is a slightly more intelligent marketing of that product, then it's usually a comped model.
But like on the advisory side, when you look at, you mainly are involved in the strategic planning or you also operationalize?
So end to end.
As well.
And then there are scenarios where you're actually plugged in for one specific part of that entire life cycle of that project.
Right.
But I mean, we're very flexible. It completely depends on the objectives of the client.
And so for example, and this might be like a very silly and oversimplifying this case. Let's say I'm a big Canadian alcohol brand and I have zero presence in India. And I'm like, you know what? Like this is an emerging market. Like guys are drinking, men and women are spending a significant portion of their money in F&B. I want to make inroads into India. Let's say I discovered that, you know what, DSSC is something, someone that can help me out with this.
Yeah.
How long would that, like, how would it end? Let's say, would you give me like a go-to-market strategy? Would you help me with an event? Will you help me design a brand camp? Like, is that sort of all the things that you would cover typically? And how long
pretty
does it last?
Much. Well, okay. So typically like how brands are, like say, for example, the case that you just submitted, what happens is that usually the bulk of the work happens in the research phase.
Okay.
Which is what just kind of mapping out what are your objectives and who is your target audience. Once you kind of like funnel it down to like say five big things that your brand wants to achieve in like say FY 2019-20, we start working on building a more 360 approach to go to market, which would be a good healthy mix of online and on ground.
Okay.
So for online, you know, whatever the digital campaigns are, what kind of like tone and voice you want to build, right from like design to copy to, you know, influencer marketing to video campaigns, whatever that gamut is, to your offline activations, right from like your big bang launch to smaller activations for brand awareness to brand kind of advocacy to everything. So it kind of like, I mean, typically a lot of brands come to us for the end-to-end scenario, but for a lot of like established, for example, alcohol companies who've been in the market for like so many decades and years, we usually plug and play into certain kind of lifetimes of that project.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's interesting because especially for new brands, right? Like, I mean, they really must be putting their trust in you because first impressions are important for brands, right? Like, especially when you're
and in a
market.
Very noisy landscape. So
it is, correct.
It's more critical.
Yeah. And sort of on the digital side, right? Like, is social media a big piece of the pie, a big piece of the puzzle, rather?
Okay, so this is a bit of a conflicting answer.
Okay.
My work answer for this question is yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is very critical because you can only get this much footprint and access offline, but you get a 150x online.
Okay.
So you want like a blanket, like a wider reach of brand awareness. Yes, it is very important you employ all your digital platforms and assets at play. My personal answer is, I give it less importance than a lot of other people in the industry because I feel the intimacy of offline is way more powerful than the potential virality of online.
Correct. Yeah. That's well.
And
good,
I
actually.
Feel like a lot of consumers are getting more discerning by the minute in terms of like also kind of being a little more discerning about what they consume online now. I feel like, say, 3 years back, yes, online was the space to be. I feel
now... I think
now,
that has also gone in a cycle, right? Like, there was a time, I think, when social media platforms came in for the first time. Like, people were just very excited about sharing everything about them.
Yeah,
their,
and you're so
entire,
curious.
You know, their
yeah.
entire day. They were very kind of curious to know about what others are doing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, I think after 7-8 years of that cycle, now you want more privacy. Suddenly data has become, like we discuss data here a lot in these podcast sessions. And like we keep on wondering that how come, you know, suddenly email or WhatsApp, peer-to-peer communication, even like Mark Zuckerberg is saying that, you know, Facebook now has to stop being a social media and go towards P2P, private chat rooms.
Yeah.
So I guess offline does mirror
Absolutely.
That in a way, right? So,
and I feel like sometimes we have greater control over the kind of like the long form or the storytelling of that product offline as opposed to online. Because the connotation and the interpretation of what you kind of gather and read online, it has too many loose ends.
Right.
So I feel like offline, there are so many more touch points and interesting touch points to get the consumer closer to the product or the service.
But do you feel that in the market, especially when you look at search engine optimization or, social media optimization, scheduling, a lot of people talk about it, but there are very few agencies which actually, I think, know what they're doing. Like, there's a lot of noise there, in terms of, because in terms of the media platforms itself, they are intermediating the process. Then on top of that, you have agencies who are intermediating that process.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the one thing that I tell my brands. You want to earmark some form of digital spend.
Right.
Don't have the hope and dream in the day that you're going to get some fabulous conversion on it.
Right.
It's almost as, because your competitor's parking that kind of percentage of funds into digital, or you feel that that's the way to go. But what is Facebook now?
Right.
I miss the family album format of Facebook.
Yeah.
I feel for businesses, there's a reason why people are dropping off Facebook.
Right.
Because it's almost like burning your marketing budgets.
Yeah.
Even when you try promote via Facebook, via their legitimate channels of advertising, more often than not, it's actually a completely irrelevant set of people who end up viewing your promotion. So, digital spends have to be worked in a very different format now.
Facebook, I think, has now become, a kind of a need to be on kind of a platform. Yeah, but in terms of, actual value addition,
it's a necessary evil. Yeah. Everyone needs their presence there. Are people pumping in the same kind of monies into Facebook as opposed to their same sister concern Instagram? No. Not as much.
Right.
Yeah. No.
Not as much.
Interesting episode from my previous stint was, I think it was 15-16, and I used to cover the media stocks, the North American media stocks, and a lot of television broadcasting companies were seeing a massive downsize in the advertising revenue because all of the advertising dollars were sort of going online to the Facebooks of the world. Mm. And what happened was, interestingly, the subsequent year, so this is 15-16 now, we saw the return of television all of a sudden. And people start saying, well, it's a small base, so it will adjust. But it went up again. And we spoke to a lot of brand managers and they said, we're not getting our ROI. We don't even know how much of conversion has happened. There is a big element of actually calculating how much of ROI you're getting by those advertising dollars on digital. And that sort of TV was sort of, thought of as it's going everywhere. There's at least some kind of...
But that's the thing, right? I feel like it moved from your traditional media.
Yeah, it's a balance
to
at
an
the end.
Online spend. And now a lot of brands are carefully and slowly exploring OTT. And that's where you're pumping in your marketing monies now.
Yeah.
It's either offline or OTT. And no one cares that much about.
Yeah, Nikhil and I have spent a lot of time talking about OTT as well.
Too much time on OTT.
Oh my God, I want in. That's my favorite topic. Can I please loop in next time?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. We'll do an OTT special next time.
Yes.
we are pretty much responsible for... 300 million number that Hotstar hit because we were talking about it so much, So
gold standard of Indian content and how they've aged the ad board model.
And similarly, Game of Thrones episodes also lost a lot of traffic when we were going live. So
took a break. That's the reason.
Guys, we need to redirect all the brand managers to come speak to you now.
We are again falling in the trap of patting our backs, and then not awaiting any external validation. So. But yeah, it's interesting because I think when you were talking of this offline to online, I was thinking offline at that. If I also consider television to be non-online, it's not pure offline. Fair. But television is pretty much a broadcast medium.
Yeah.
Then social media came; it became a very pointed medium. But now I think it is pretty much looked at as a broadcast medium itself, except maybe an Instagram, which has a slightly more specialist audience. Right, but no wonder the cycle is going places on one end or the other. But Instagram must be like, being, because you're, I think, you're into the curation domain, Instagram being a very visual medium must be pretty important. I noticed that you have like 59,000 followers.
Yeah, so Instagram for us still is a way more...
By the way, plus one for research.
Yeah, well,
it's on the paper, my friend. It's there.
LinkedIn check.
Yeah.
Instagram check. I'm very impressed, guys. Yeah. But yes, Instagram is still, for us at least, in our limited understanding, it's a very useful tool, not only for outreach, but also discovery. And I mean like both ways, not only us kind of like pushing out, but also pulling in kind of knowledge and information. So for us, Instagram is a really, really great platform, and for our brand partners. So in fact, like a lot of our brand partners come on board kind of like asking us to build campaigns, keeping just that in mind, only for Instagram, which is why, I mean, you could speak to a lot of videographers and video production companies, and it's only in the last, like, say, 3 years have contracts started adding in a clause saying we also need an added deliverable of a video of these many seconds and these many minutes, catering only for Instagram.
But how do you also differentiate on Instagram? Because, I mean, I always think that it's different from other platforms, because I think it's more engaging, definitely. It's more personal also, right? At the end of the day, it's something that, you know, like people go have a good meal, they take a nice picture, you know, people, someone is wearing nice, something nice, they take a... But like in all that, how do you differentiate yourself? Because like F&B itself is, again, a very visual domain, right?
Yeah.
So like what's the kind of USP of a campaign which DSSC does, for instance,
so
versus a lot of the other things?
I'm only going to speak on our behalf.
Yeah.
I don't know what works for a lot of... Because we've also spent a lot of time kind of understanding what is that magic formula for Instagram. No one has the answer.
Right.
But I will tell you, at least for us, what really worked was our kind of our content and our copy. So I think it really kind of worked in our favor that there was a lot more research that was going in, not only towards like the visual aspect of a campaign or a post or a story or what have you, but also the story, the actual written story that supports it.
Right.
So I think the members that started off, you know, in the early days of DSSC, who still remain with us, at no point did they drop off.
When you say members, like these guys are basically attendees of your experiences?
Yeah, so members would mean like, have you ever kind of like been part of an offline activation of the club?
Okay.
So it's a mix. Now, I mean, also we have an open profile, so there are like a lot of readers and followers who are not members. Sorry.
Right.
So it's a mix on Instagram. But I feel like for us that really worked was our tone and our signature voice that really helped.
Plus that network effect which comes from the offline.
Yeah.
I mean, those
You know, I feel like what happens is that I think when you're growing or when a company is growing, that growth sometimes also really reflects on your digital platform. So when you're either with an injection of investment or funds or how you grow and scale, more often than not, at least in the last 3-4 years, the companies that we were tracking, we would see a significant dip in their content.
Right.
And I feel like we resisted that and we said we're going to continue paying that kind of attention to
But it's a difficult mix, right? You kind of, in terms of like having a well thought out copy, comes at the expense of scale, right? Because there have to be guys who do that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it cannot really be automated beyond a limit. Like
we
also kind of... We are often, you know, we like to think of ourselves as a user-generated content platform.
Yeah.
But we don't publish anything instantly, right?
Absolutely.
We kind of take it through a cycle.
Yeah.
And same is with your content, obviously, in a different
theme.
But like, is it like you think like, okay, I really don't want to do that many campaigns at a time? Do you put some sort of rules on yourself to make sure that you have the bandwidth to execute
that
quality?
So I feel sometimes it's really important to remember like your 3 to 5 big USPs and why you started off.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you scale, you grow, you get in, like you get funded, you don't get funded, you're self-sustaining, whatever the format is, if you stick to those 3 big USPs, that's not going to really alter your path too much, or you're not going to deviate from it too much. So for us, we know that we are in the luxury segment of experiential marketing or digital campaigns or copywriting. So there's only this much allowance in that niche exclusive luxury segment where you can like kind of let growth or scale affect any of that. So in line with that, yes, it is a lot more time consuming. So sometimes the input output does not make sense.
Right.
But we know that's what we're known for. So it's it's now kind of like ingrained in our DNA and our like thought map. That's how we function.
So you're not, you basically are not targeting for everyone. You're targeting
niche. Yeah, absolutely
you,
not.
Like you have identified your audience.
We know our audience. We're sticking to kind of like speaking to the requirements and needs of that specific audience, which is why we ended up saying no to like very good investment about 3 to 4 times in the last 2 years, because that came with the gentle caveat of what their vision of growth and scale was, which was this, as opposed to we wanted to go deeper.
Good for you, though. That's pretty... So you're preserving the sort of authenticity of what your vision is. That's,
yeah,
I think, important. And so well done on that.
Thank you.
And you feel free to take this question with as much detail or as little. But in terms of competitors, okay, let's call domestic. And when I say competitors, not just guys in firms who are competing with you, but also... there are these aspirational firms, maybe in the international markets, right? You know, they're doing fantastically. Maybe one day we could sort of get up there and maybe even get past them. So do you have, like, are there any names that you think about?
Yeah, we have. I mean, our biggest competitor is only one, and that's Netflix.
Okay.
Okay, wow. So we're very clear about that. And all of Netflix is literally the, because, you know, the thing is, a lot of our, online or offline, the only thing that we're asking from our target audience and the discerning, curious target audience is their time.
You know what, when someone asks Reed Hastings, CEO of Netflix, what his biggest competitor is, you know what he says, right? Fortnite.
Oh,
it's the same logic.
Yeah,
same logic.
Exactly. But, yeah, there you go. Oh, great points.
YouTube and Fortnite, yeah.
But that's the thing, right? So I am basically fighting with anyone who's trying to get quality, kind of uninterrupted,
right,
discerning time from my target audience, which is not the masses right now.
Right.
So in line with that, I know basically we don't plan events when we know a major Netflix drop is happening. We just don't. We don't.
Right.
So in my mind, everything we do, every piece of copy, every article, every event, every what have you, it has to be something that is worth their while to get off Netflix and invest in us.
Yeah, so, sure. That sounds fairly logical. And at the end of the day, you're fighting for eyeballs, right? I mean, there is a little bit of quality eyeballs, let's call it.
Yeah.
And maybe there's an overlap in the sort of audience that you're catering to and the order and the audience that, let's call it,
I mean,
Netflix,
like,
original.
You know, I feel like that's the thing. That goes back to kind of like what I was saying about being aware about what space you're in. We know our consumers have the flexibility and also the desire to spend.
Right.
That's well established. Our brands know that. We know that. The consumers know that. Now, so if money isn't the equity that we're fighting for, it's time.
But like when you kind of say that Netflix is a competitor, right?
Yeah.
Is that based on a hunch that the target audience that you are aiming for spend a lot of time on that, or you actually got some internal insight, some data point, you did a survey, like how did you come
so
to that?
No, so we actually
that...
checked with our members,
right?
And also like actually it just so helps, which is why it's so critical to get the right team in place for a concept like this, because the team is usually the target audience for a bunch of our brand partners.
Right.
So if it isn't worth my time, then I know it's not going to be worth my members' time, because I need to be a kind of like almost a aggregate collated
mirror
of
reflecting the
of our entire user base.
Right.
So which is why I mean, like, that's our key competitor.
Nice, ambitious competitor. And but the best thing is that
they wouldn't care about us, but in my head I'm like,
that's the way it is, right? And he's also thinking of the same thing at the end of the day, right?
And so we've had the good fortune of at least associating with Netflix India.
Right.
And which is why we have so much respect for them, because they're actually right now, currently, they're the best platforms who are catering to a very big gap.
Yeah.
And how do you convert people's time?
Right.
And in fact, can I just tell you, his answer was also sleep.
Oh, was it?
His competitor was sleep.
Well, I remember Fortnite and YouTube. Yeah, sleep is probably the other one, right?
Yeah, they're competing against sleep, and which is why they're crunching down now. There's a reason why binge watching, that phrase, is so relevant in our generation as opposed to any other.
No, that's true.
Because Netflix is eating into your sleep time now.
That's why I don't start anything new there. I know it's going to be a big commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of just wrecks your schedule.
Yeah.
So
true.
Yeah, they're kind of getting there slowly.
Since sort of your expertise, and so let's spend a couple of minutes, I guess, talking about what's happening in the food space, and let's give it a very Delhi touch too, because we're sort of, I know you're spread across the country, I guess, but your sort of home is Delhi. Yeah. And so what's like, is, I don't even know, is fusion food in, specialty restaurants in, is it experimental food, is it authentic cuisines? What is sort of hot these days in the marketplace?
I think we've done a big cycle of what's really worked, what's not, what was a great marketing gimmick, what was experimental, what was luxury, what was gourmet, what was whatever. But I personally feel, and I see, like when we slice and dice our data, I feel a lot of consumers are also kind of like ready and willing to spend bigger bucks on authentic, local, regional cuisine.
Right.
And I feel like it's such a good time for the industry where we're actually saying goodbye vegetables that were flown in from halfway around the world.
Right.
And thereby destroy its flavor and its freshness and just like its profile. And we're leaning back towards inward, meaning which we have some fantastic chefs and establishments. And even alcohol brands, which are now looking inward and say, how do we source local? How do we kind of consciously and mindfully eat? How do we build amazing plates of food which respect our heritage and our technique, which is actually one of the most solid across the globe? And a lot of restaurants that are working off that and in a non-gimmicky way, they're doing great.
Yeah.
Across Delhi, I mean, Bombay, anywhere, you know?
I mean, in terms of like my personal knowledge of this area, I mean, besides eating the stuff, it's not very extensive. Yeah. But like, I do read Root Food every weekend.
Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, and I think Veer Sanghvi, like, I think his entire style of writing on food is so much superior to anything else that he writes. Yeah. So I'm a big fan. So
he's amazing.
Yeah, when he kind of writes, his main, I think, philosophy has been that the Frenchification of Indian food is one of the biggest problems that the chefs face with.
To attribute sophistication because of, you know, smaller portions or cleaner plating or kind of like using your forceps into like plating.
I think he mocks a lot of the London-based Indian restaurants because of that reason, right?
Yeah, because I feel like it's neither authentic nor is it celebrating what the country stands for. And in terms of like cuisine history and culture, we go like centuries back. And for some reason, there's some form of like shyness, if not anything else, where we don't embrace it till an international
I think that's also it's a generation thing as well, right? I mean, I don't have any data to back it, obviously. I'm just saying it based on, I remember there was a time when we used to enter five-star hotels or flights. Everybody used to speak in English. And, you know, then there was a moment when I realized that, okay, no, things are, people are more comfortable in their own regional language.
Yeah.
Right? It takes some years to kind of also get that, I won't say colonial hangover or anything, but that entire mindset of being more proud of your identity, that also takes some...
No, absolutely true. Or maybe just that...
this podcast is like, in English, so I don't know why I said that. But yeah, let's just let that flow.
No,
yeah.
I mean, like, things like it took what, like an Australian cafe to tell us that a turmeric latte is very good for us. Or the fact that in US they had to market or more intelligently market and package yoga to tell the world how good it is. Whereas, you know, we've grown up, and not just us, but our grandparents have grown up drinking haldi doodh all their life.
Right.
And reaping the benefits of having kacha haldi in water or milk.
Yeah.
You know, so I feel like sometimes it's almost like now I think we're going back and we're embracing what we're known for.
But is it like a question of marketing or packaging it, right? I mean, often like you actually need someone to go in, discover it, and then
disagree. I hate that someone else needs to tell us what we're already good at. We already know.
No, like even within India, often you'll see
instance, it just wasn't sexy enough.
Yeah, so how to make that?
We went through like a life cycle where it was incredibly aspirational and lust worthy if your truffles were being flown down from a remote forest in Italy, as opposed to us sourcing these fantastic kind of products in season from Kashmir.
What are they called? They're not called truffles though. Do we have truffles in India?
No.
No, right? There is something, a close proxy. I might be wrong. Anyway, we're digressing, but...
I feel I love it that now the industry sees... you see that shift happen every few months. where people are going back to seasonal and right. not serving you something that should not be served that season.
Right.
And it's, you know, consumers are embracing it. The industry seems to be working with the pricing of it. So that's where I feel the industry is headed.
I'm not on Instagram, but on Twitter. And I remember about, was it a couple of months back that the DSSC had a Thali event, which sort of celebrated, let's call it, cuisines from different parts of India, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And so it literally, can I just tell you how it came about?
Sure.
Because we share space with my dad's firm.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sick of us talking about these gourmet meals and menus that we were crafting from every other region of the globe.
Okay.
Till this one time in my Thali, my dad is a Thali also. But my dad is like a big Thali connoisseur, and he would just be like, one day, why can't you just do something around bhavans and thalis? And you know how fabulously kind of scientific it is.
Right.
So it kind of like got to a point where we said, yeah, why not?
Yeah.
And it is the original chef's tasting. And that kind of gave birth to the Thali tradition.
So paternal pressure.
Paternal pressure.
That always works.
Yeah. Oh,
very
always.
Effective. Food and paternal pressure. Yeah.
Two drivers of this business.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's very, very fascinating to hear in terms of, you know, where the entire F&B scene is moving. But like when you, like, let's kind of rewind 6-7 years back when you came in. You came from London.
Yes.
Again, very active food scene there.
Absolutely.
Like, very innovative.
Yeah.
From there, you came here. Like, when you came here, you were like, oh, there's like a lot of stuff which can happen or which is not happening. Or you were like, okay, that it's already happening and I'm going to be part of that ride.
No, so see, I feel like any segment of this food cycle is exciting for me.
Right.
Because I just enjoy that entire process. Was it exciting to see so much like nitrogen and infuse this and infuse that in my food? Not really, because it was more gimmicky.
Right.
In London, you have so many more farmers markets and kind of farm to fork concepts
right.
that were missing when I came back. And now we're headed there. So that's the more exciting bit. I mean, and not just food, but the fact that it took us so long to get, you know, locally made gin,
right.
which was sourced, bottled, everything end to end here, and then craft beer or tonic water.
Yeah.
I feel like that kind of shift, it just in a span of like, if you think about it, 6-7 years is nothing.
Right.
But in 6-7 years, not only food, but fashion, but everything else and alcohol and mixers, we're seeing that shift so dramatically.
But I mean, you know, in terms of, I guess, food and this entire, you know, I would say, formalized food sector was probably an area of passion for you even when you were there, right? I mean, this is something that you were interested in naturally.
Really
maybe not
sorry,
from a very...
But no, other than eating had like zero.
Yeah, I mean, but at least you were kind of... This was something kind of core to your interest, maybe just
in
from a...
In hindsight, maybe.
Yeah.
But at that point in time, it's such a bad answer, but no, not at all.
Yeah.
It literally... I wish I had a better answer to this. But I feel like this almost originated from a place of severe boredom.
Right.
Where it came to a point where my parents were like, either go back, since you're more comfortable in that scenario, or try and make Delhi your home.
How long did that period last for you? Like in terms of just trying to figure it out?
I want to say 6 months.
Right. Were you trying different things during
those 6 months? No, I was already working on projects. Right?
Oh, okay.
So I was working on projects, working with farmers in Mewat and getting them like straight to market and creating that supply chain. So
right.
I was working on projects, but in terms of like just experiences or where should food culture head or how should brands like market their products, that for me, there was a gap,
right.
which is why it kind of gave birth to...
But typically, you know, like we... I guess as an entrepreneur, you must have evaluated, I don't know, a few ideas.
Yeah.
Right?
No.
Oh, no.
Again,
this was it?
Like, I have such bad answers to this. But like,
no, these are probably good answers.
These are probably good answers.
I wish I had like a smarter response to it. But just, I feel like in any case, anyone who knows me knows how risk averse I am. The first time I wrote an email to the director back at Ernst & Young London and I told them about the project, and even they were just like, you are traditionally a very risk-averse person.
Okay.
This seems like a leap of faith. Do it.
Right.
If it doesn't work, come back.
Right.
And in many ways and forms, the risk-averse mind said that, oh, if it doesn't work, I have the opportunity of going back. Let's do it now. So I neither had a kitty of projects or ideas that I had been mulling about, nor did I test it, it was literally you jump into the deeper side of the pool.
Right.
And you figure out a way to swim. At least in my case, that's how it happened.
So I guess...
And I learned everything on the job because I don't have any hospitality background.
Right. But like now that 6-7 years have gone by, things are, I guess, structured, stable, scaling up, but still some process around things.
So I feel like it helps that you're an eco-finance grad.
Right.
And then you're half Marwadi.
Right,
so your numbers always...
I think
like
the second one, you're understating a bit.
Yeah.
I mean... So we always say that we need to hire like a Marwadi person just to make ourselves a legit business,
So Chef Ritu Dalmia, in all her interviews or in some of her interviews, she's so sweet. She says something that being a Marwadi woman, forget like Marwadi man, she says being a Marwadi woman, automatically you know that business is in good hands.
Right.
And from the first secret supper till date, we've been self-sustaining. We've been in the green. We've been careful with where we park our funds and how we grow and scale. So in that sense, there were a lot of elements from the skill set I picked up from my studies and my first few jobs and applied it here.
I'm very sure in a couple of years' time, Netflix earning call, they're going to add the SSC to that list of sleep Fortnite and YouTube.
And hire a Marwadi CTO or something like that, just to kind of make it a bit more
foolproof. Reach out, I'll just send you my email.
Yeah, yeah. But like two questions, First is, startups are like, let's raise funds, go for institutions.
Yeah.
You haven't really, I think, pushed for that strategy, or maybe you did, but you didn't find a match. I don't know. Like, you can answer that. That is first.
Yeah.
Second is, what scares you right now? Like, what bothers you? Is there something that bothers you? Or you think that we are on the right track and we'll be able to
navigate? I'm going to answer the first one first.
Yeah.
In terms of like whether we ever actively looked out for funds, we never felt the need.
Right.
And I don't mean to like sound cocky about it, but I know there is no such thing as a free lunch. And I know what the expectations and the deliverables and the targets that were kind of like matched against that check or that round of funds. So over the last few years, we have been approached by some fabulous people, but their bent of mind was not understanding how you grow and scale in luxury curation and immersive marketing.
Right.
So you can't view me as the same way you view a tech product or a tech service. Thereby that multiple and the expense of that multiple never really married my vision of
is that a question of not a lot of guys doing what you were doing here, so they don't have any comparable companies to? Because I think like investors often need to
I mean, we also have some of the smartest minds in the country right now who are, with VCs or individual investors.
Like the reason why I'm saying that is we come from a finance background, right?
Yeah.
So when we look at investors,
and
by the way, like FI, we love investor bashing in this podcast, so that's something nice. But I mean, like that being said,
I have many stories for you on a separate note.
Yeah, maybe
questions that I was asked during my investment.
Yeah, that's always a kind of a fun thing, to explore. But like often they have a limited bit of time when they interact with you, right?
Yeah.
So they quickly need some sort of a framework to put your business right? That you think was a kind of a where it gets
a
bit lost in translation?
I will give them credit that they understood our model.
Okay.
And I will give them complete respect and credit that they also understood our vision of scale and growth.
Right.
I don't think the problem here was the exit strategy or the multiple or what the forecast was.
Right.
I don't think that was the problem. I think it was our vision not necessarily clicking of my definition of growth and scale, which in my mind is never going actually horizontal. It's going vertical.
Right.
And by vertical, I mean like
deep. Right.
That's my view, because I also understand there is no benchmark or a comparable company like DSSE, but if you're contributing to the cultural fabric of whatever city you're kind of working and operating out of, then you're working with like a big set of intangibles.
Right.
And I can understand that not necessarily
not translating across.
Yeah. Right. So which is why we kind of like very politely thanked, but we refused, because we didn't want to scale and grow with their vision.
Right. So no AI, ML coming in, no blockchain.
Not now. Never say never, but not now.
Nice. And what about like in terms of what you think?
What scares me?
I mean, scares might be like a bit of a, I just wanted to like get your attention. But yeah. What there must be some things which are on your mind, right, as entrepreneur?
Again, I have such a bad answer for this. Nothing really in terms of like the usual set of challenges that, you know, I feel as an entrepreneur, you're almost like, you get comfortable with rolling with the punches. Okay. That if you have a day that's too stable and too easy, that's what your red flag antenna goes up.
Right.
For me, I'm not scared with those set of challenges. I mean, you learn and you grow and you kind of like readjust and all of that. What scares me is of the day, should I ever get bored of contributing to the cultural fabric of whatever city I'm in?
Right.
I just really fear the day that I hope I never get to a stage where I feel dulled by it.
Right.
You know, so irrespective of how chaotic the landscape is, I'm every day I'm very excited about my work.
It shows.
That's I just don't want to be bored of it. That's my big fear.
That's very evidently visible. And this was a very...
Alcohol helps, guys.
Well, unleashing alcohol and advising how to unleash it.
Especially in the afternoon. So it wasn't black coffee. I mean, we went Irish in between, apparently.
Drink responsibly, guys. Yeah. Everyone who's listening.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think... And we are hitting 58th minute of our podcast. Time just flew. And... we don't have any rules. We can continue chatting if you want. But I think this was a very nice and positive note to end today's conversation. I hope our listeners enjoy this. And this is like our typical conversation is much drier. So this kind of is, I think, you know.
Breath of fresh air.
From.
I'm glad.
And as a woman entrepreneur, I didn't want to raise that. But since that was the joke we started with offline in the beginning, it's always a pleasure to...
Yeah, my favorite line, guys.
Yeah.
I love being introduced as that.
Yes. Yeah, we did not, right? I think we just said the name.
I hate that.
Good stuff. Thank you so much for your time and all. I don't know if you need any luck, but you have the luck from Transfin team or the podcasting team. And
always need luck.
We'll obviously closely track your company from a personal standpoint and obviously from professionally. Would love to see it grow.
Absolutely. And yeah, so with that... thanks, everyone. I think we can, before signing off, sorry, the usual disclaimer, do feel free to comment and subscribe, share your feedback. If anyone wants to come over and have a conversation, do come here because generally it's always fun to be more than two people praising each other. So yeah, with that, this is Nikhil Arora.
And this is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.